the innkeeper said. Roman, they say. Not many came this far. They found the Scots too hard for them. Too hard by far. We ate, straining our ears to make out the muttered conversation between the others. From time to time they looked at us, but in no friendly or curious fashion. Rather, it was suspicion. We could make out nothing of what they were saying, but when the chance came, I eased my staff across my knees, ready to hand. One whom we took to be a soldier stared hard at us and then said suddenly, "'Tis not many, come this way." Angus wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. "Aye, nor would I, but the lad returns home, and I am showing him the way." It was a promise made in an ill-thought moment, he added, smiling. "His father did me a kindness more than once, and now he is gone." "Dead." "Aye, killed in the Irish Wars. He was a Scot whom they settled there, and there the lad was born and raised until his family were killed. We escaped together, and now when he is safely among his own folk, I shall be off to the sea again." "You be a sailor man." "Sailed with Hawkins. 2 voyages to the Indies, trading and fighting, and the last time a prisoner in Spain. But Sir John looks after his own, and ransomed me out. And now, when I've taken the lad north, I shall be off to join him again." He paused, gulping down a swallow of ale. "There's talk that the Spanish are readying a great fleet of ships to go against England, so the fighting may be here, along our own coasts." This was news indeed, and for a while we were forgotten in the talk bandied back and forth. Many in Scotland were not at all friendly to England, but most of them liked the Spanish even less. Yet the comment had done what Angus intended, and taken their minds from us. They argued the effects of such an attack. Some thought Spain was too mighty for England to stand against, but others mentioned Hawkins, Martin Frobisher, and mariners noted for their skill at sea fighting. "There's another too," Angus Fair suggested. "The name is Drake, Francis Drake. He sailed with Hawkins and made a name for himself among Hawkins's men. He is a man to be reckoned with." "Ah," the innkeeper said gloomily. "England is but a small nation, and Spain is the greatest upon the world's seas. England will have no chance, none at all." We finished our meal, and I listened to the fury of the wind outside, and the rain lashing against the shutters. It was a bitter bad night without, and the walls and fire were a comfort. We finished our meal, and I looked longingly at the floor near the fire, but knew it was not for me. Others had come first. Yet I drew my coat about me and huddled closer, fighting the chill at my back. From outside there suddenly came a clatter and a banging, and then the door was thrown open in a gust of howling wind that set the flames a-roaring on the hearth. In the wide-open door stood a huge man wrapped in a sheepskin cloak, the leather side outside, and a great fur cap now sodden with rain. He had a red beard and bushy brows of red, and there was a great scar on his cheekbone, partly hidden by the beard. He stepped into the room, and even against that mighty wind, he slammed the door so it shook the house. Without a word, he strode to the fire. The men pulled back abruptly, although he said no word. He swept off his sheepskin and dropped it over a cask in the corner.
"Ale,"
he said, and his voice boomed harshly in the small room. Then he sat down with his back to the room and extended his big hands to the fire. I stared at those huge hands. A finger was missing from one. 2 nails were gone from another. There were scars upon both hands, yet their power was obvious. The soldiers, who had appeared so threatening a few moments before, huddled back from him, eyes averted. He carried a claymore, which was a huge 2-handed sword, and a dagger as well. Seeing some apples on the table, he reached over and took one of them, turning it in his fingers. Then he drew the blade, laid the apple upon the back of his left hand, and with a single deft stroke, hacked it in two, without scratching his hand. That blade was obviously razor sharp. But it was not the sharpness that drew my eyes, but the serrated back edge of the blade. The blade itself was wide and strong, but that serrated edge made the knife what was known as a sword breaker. For a blade caught in the notches could, with a deft twist of the wrist, be broken, snapped right off. I had heard of such knives, but never seen their like. My father had told me of fighting men, skilled in their use. The big man, and he would have made two of Angus, ate his apple. The crunching loud in a room where, but for the fire, a silence had fallen. The innkeeper came with a great mug of ale, and the big man took it and drank it half empty at a draught. He glanced around the room then, impaling each of us with a glance that told him all he wished to know. His eyes lingered longest upon me, as if for some reason I struck a discordant note. It frightened me, for it was as if he saw all that I was, and who I was, with that single glance. He said nothing, finishing his ale and calling for food. He looked around suddenly at the innkeeper.
"What distance to Ayr? I have gone that way, but it has been long since."
"By the track, belike 30 mile. I have not gone so far myself." Angus spoke quietly, almost as if to himself.
"It is our road, too."
The big man stared at him. "We seek a boat there," he said, "to the high coast of Scotland, or to the Isle of Lewis."
"We shall go together, then,"
the big man said, and thrust his mug out for more ale.
"Before the break of day, if you walk with me."
Sweet was the walking in the grey time of dawning. Sweet the smell of rain-fresh grass, and the dark loom of grey granite above the green, with, here and there, a darker shrub. It was the land I loved, where no people were. Only us walking, and no talk among us for a long time. The rain had gone, but the clouds hung low, heavy with promise and warning. We walked on, matching our strides to his, as well as we could, leaving the inn behind us, and pleased that it be behind. A dark bird flashed across, flying low, and a moor stallion lifted his heavy maned head and stared at us from a quarter of a mile off, then tossed his head and walked a few steps toward us, as if in challenge. I had no trouble for him. He was a noble beast, and understood the sweet wine of freedom, which he drank deep on these lonely moors, with the highlands rising up nearby. When we had walked a good hour into the morning, the big man looked over at me and said,
"You seek Fergus MacCaskill?"
Surprised, I looked at him.
"I do." "And for what reason?"
"I have trained with the sword. I wish to be the best swordsman in the world. And I once thought I'd been well taught by my father and a gypsy named Corey. Then I fought a lad but 4 years older than myself, and he beat me badly. He bested me at every turn. I would learn more, and they have said that Fergus MacCaskill comes of a long line of fighting men, and that he is the greatest of swordsmen."
"You wish to go back and beat that one who bested you?"
"Yesterday I did. Today, it is less important. What I wish is that it not happen again, with another than he, or even with himself, if we should meet again. And I think we shall."
"He had a name?"
"Leckenby. Rafe Leckenby."
"Ah.
You know him?"
"I do not. But Tuesday he killed a man at Kirkcudbright. I saw him there, and he was good. He was very good. And he was fighting a man whom I knew."
He looked at me.
"You are alive, therefore you are no novice."
We walked on.
"It was said that he had killed 4 men before this, one of them a soldier at Carlisle, another a Danish swordsman at Berwick-upon-Tweed."
We walked along.
"You are very young, but you are strong for a lad. I will see what we can do. You will teach me. Is it not what you want? I am Fergus MacCaskill. Chapter 14. We set out for Ayr with the sun not yet up, and I doubt not there would have been trouble had it not been for Fergus MacCaskill, for there had been those about the inn who liked us not. Now he strode out upon the path, and we walked beside or followed, as the way permitted. The man had massive shoulders, not only broad but thick with muscle. Yet I hesitated over his swordsmanship. A claymore is a cut-and-slash blade, and a man with such power in him would be mighty indeed with such a blade. Yet it was the art of fence in which I was interested, as it was taught in the Italian towns or France, and somewhat in Spain. Could such a man have the delicacy to handle a rapier or a thrusting sword? Ayr was a bustling place when we arrived, and it was nightfall when we came into the streets. Sore tired we were, and hungered too, for it had been little enough we'd had in the dawning, and not throughout the day. Angus Fair was a careful man, and in this town I saw him more so. He came to a halt inside the town. "Best I leave you here," he said. "There may be those about who seek me, and I would not involve you in my troubles." "Aye," MacCaskill agreed. "I would not have the lad embroiled in troubles, not if he's seeking. And I think he does not need questions now. The inn to which we will go will ask no questions. But do you come along after we enter? Do you speak quietly to Murray, who is host there? Speak for the room at the back. He will know at once what you wish, and it will cost you a bit more. But if those come who seek you, there is a window over the back and an easy way down. Beyond that, there is a narrow place between the stable and the brewing room, and you may go through into a lane. Hold to it. Below lies the dune, and not far off is the Brigadoon. But if you wish, there are boats. Take one. But do you leave it at Dunure? Yon's a fishing village. A small place with the harbour silting now. There'll be an old place by the waterside with two lanterns, one high, one low. Do you tie the boat below the high lantern and go your way?" "It seems," I said, "you have been this way before."
"Aye, lad.
And not even a mouse trusts himself to one hole only. The inn is a safe place, with a half-dozen ways for a man to escape without being seen. There are smugglers and such come there, and many who would not be seen too well, and I among them." "But you are a man who could not be unseen," I protested. "There are not two like you in the world."
"'Tis a broad place, the world. I doubt not there's a double for every man, somewhere about. But 'tis true. Not many have my size, and I am a known man. All I can do is keep myself from sight, for there be those who hunt me down." He put a hand on my shoulder. "We've enemies, you and me, and not a few that seek us. I've a place yon on Lewes, the Isle of Lewis, some do call it, but Lewes to me. I've a place there, and we will go there and listen to the gulls of a morning, and perhaps a lark in the afternoon, and we'll work a bit with the blades, you and me." He looked at me suddenly. "You've a face not to be forgotten, lad. So we must do something about showing you how to make it different. Although you'll find few enemies in Scotland, I'm thinking." "Tartan Chantry, what a name it is. Some day you must tell me how you came by it. But there's no need now. Although," he added, "I'd have believed you had enemies enough without adding to them." What he meant by that I did not know. But we'd come to the door of the inn, so I asked no question then. We went down four steps and then took a turn to the right. Down three more, he opened a heavy door and we entered. It was a wide room, long and low-beamed. All was dark,
except for the fire upon the wide hearth, and a low candle burning here and there. A dozen folk were in the place, men mostly, but a woman or two also, and they looked around as the wind guttered their candlelight and the fire. There was an empty table near the fire, and I wondered if they had known he was coming. But he crossed and seated himself on the bench by it. A man brought ale for each of us, and then came again with slices of thick meat and bread, which we broke in our hands. Nobody spoke to us, although all looked, and then they went on with their eating, drinking, and gambling. It was not a place where men wished to be remembered. As we ate, I looked about. The floor was of stone flags. The walls were of stone also. And there were several doors, all closed, but that to the kitchen and tap room. Some pots were on the fire, and there was a good smell of broiling meat, too, as a chunk of beef turned on a spit. He who brought the bread leaned over and whispered, and I dimly heard,
"Tammy is by the boat this hour, Fergus," he whispered. "He stands ready. We will be there."
The man put the bread over a bit toward me, and took a quick glance at me.
"Remember the lad well," Fergus said. "He is my friend." "Aye, there have been some about not your friends too."
The door opened again, and I looked around, as did the others. It was Angus Phair. He looked not our way, but went to a corner away from the fire. We ate, and I had not known how hungry I was. Fergus looked at my hands.
"You've good hands, lad. I think we will make a swordsman of you."
"MacCaskill," I said, "are you not allied to the MacLeod?"
"That we be, and when the clan goes to battle, there's ever a MacCaskill in the forefront."
"Do you know the clans, then?"
"Only a bit.
My father knew of them and had some connection. I know not what."
"You know, then, the story of the fairy flag? Many a way has it been told, but the one I like the best is that the fourth Lady MacLeod, hearing a sound in her baby son's room, went in to find a lovely lady in filmy green, who was lulling the baby to sleep. The lady in green vanished, but left behind the flag. It was said to be a gift from Titania, Queen of the Fairies, and to be flown but three times, when the MacLeods were in dire need. By flying it, they can call the fairies and all the powers of sky and forest to their aid."
"And have they ever?"
"Twice. At the Battle of Glendale in 1490, and Waternish in 1580. Just a few years back, that one.
Each time, the MacLeods needed a victory, and each time they won. Some say they have one more time, then the flag will vanish as it came."
"My father told me the tale, only he said it was to be used when victory was needed in battle, when the heir was in danger, or when the clan faced extinction. But no matter, 'tis a fine tale."
"Aye,
and a true one, I am thinking. But it has other attributes too, for they say that, thrown on the marriage bed, it brings children, and flown from the tower, it will bring the fish up the loch."
Glancing around, I saw that Angus Phair had vanished. His empty glass was upon his table, but he was nowhere about. Fergus MacCaskill noticed my glance.
"Gone," he said, "and well may he be, for there be spies here sometimes too."
He studied me, swallowed a gulp of ale, and put his glass down.
"You're tall, lad, and strong. I'd have judged you 2 years older. We'll go to the shore soon and have a word with Tammy. If it is safe to go to Lewes, we'll go, and if not, to Skye. There are MacCaskills in both places, and on the Isle of Man they be some. We be Vikings long since, hundreds of years ago when Laud, the son of Olaf the Black, came down and made a home in the Western Isles. Since then, there's been much of marriage with the Celts, and with the Picts, too, if all be told."
The door opened, and three men came in. I saw them come, and felt something within me turn icy cold. For one of them, I knew.
Fergus, I whispered.
I see them, lad. Do you know them, then?
The tall one. The one with the white blonde hair. He was among them who killed my father.
Did he see you then?
A glimpse only, I think. I'm a good inch taller now, maybe two, and thicker and stronger, and a good deal more brown from walking the high roads. They were coming toward us, weaving away past the others. Fergus MacCaskill held up his glass in his left hand.
"Ale!"
he said loudly. Several men who sat about lifted their glasses, each with his glass in his left hand. Each called out,
"Ale!"
The man with the blonde hair almost missed a step. He looked about quickly, as if he sensed something awry, something amiss. Then he came on. "Fergus MacCaskill?" he asked, but he looked at me.
"Aye, that be the name.
Are you coming or going?" MacCaskill smiled.
"Why, now, that depends on where a man stands, does it not? If a man is here, I might be going, and if a man be on loose, he might say, I am coming."
"Is this your son?"
"My son? Ah, I wish he were. A fine lad. They raise them well in Scotland these days, and they keep the Scotch well to them, even when schooled abroad, as is the lad here. I be taking him home to the clan."
"He's MacLeod?"
"MacLeod? Ah, no. Ken ye not the face of him? 'Tis no MacLeod. He's a MacCrimmon. He's come back to learn the pipe, for are not the greatest pipers of all, the MacCrimmons?"
The lad does look familiar. The blond man stared at me. I have seen him before.
"Why not? You've seen MacCrimmons before, and he has the look of them. Aye, if you've seen one MacCrimmon, you've seen them all. All, I say. But he's a good lad."
I am not yet sure, but I think...
"A MacCrimmon, I say! The favourite pipers of the MacLeods. And right now there'll be 100 MacLeods in the town, and 12 in the place. And never a one but would shed blood to protect a MacCrimmon."
"You." The blonde man pointed a finger at me. "I have questions for you. Come."
"Too bad it is." MacCaskill spoke cheerfully. "You didn't have come sooner, but we've no the time."
He arose to his full height, and I got up too. The blonde man was tall and strong, but not so much as Fergus MacCaskill.
"We've just been having a bite while waiting, and now's the time."
"Stay." The blonde man put up a hand. "I am an officer of the Queen. I do not believe this lad is a MacCrimmon." Fergus dropped a hand to his sword.
"Do you doubt what I say, then?"
The blonde man stood very still. I had no doubt he was a brave man, but to fight Fergus MacCaskill was certain death. He knew it, and he hesitated. MacCaskill was of no mind to push the matter.
"Very well, then." Fergus took a step back. "Let us not make much of a small thing."
The blonde man looked around him, suddenly aware that 12 men were on their feet, staring at him, each with a hand on a blade. He looked hard at me. "We shall see each other again," he said, bowing slightly. "I look forward to the meeting."
"And I," I replied, bowing also.
I jerked my thumb to indicate MacCaskill. "When my guardian is not here to protect you." He had taken a step away. Now he turned sharply around, his hand on his sword. I made as if to draw mine from its sheath, but Fergus MacCaskill put up a hand.
"No, lad. He must wait his turn. You have others to deal with first."
With that, he put a firm hand on my shoulder and thrust me toward the door, and I went. As we left, several men closed in behind us, not as if doing anything but talking or holding their glasses for drinks. Nonetheless, the way was effectually blocked. Not one could be said to have offered resistance. They simply got in the way. Outside in the dark, MacCaskill spoke quietly but firmly.
"That was a foolish thing to do. We were safely out of it, and then you had to challenge the man.
You must learn, lad, that while such a man can evade some issues, he will never avoid a direct challenge. That man was Det Kober, and as he said, he is an officer of the Queen. He is also, I might add, a superb swordsman. But he was afraid of you, I said. No, lad, not afraid, simply wise. He saw the number of those who stood about him, and the issue was not great enough. Had he been absolutely sure you were whom he believed you to be, he would have fought. Now he will simply wait and watch. As he said, there will be another time. We walked along through dark lanes to the shore. The boat lay waiting. When we were aboard, the sail was unloosed, and soon we were well out upon the water. He saw you, Fergus commented thoughtfully. But he was not in search of you. It was some other he searched for. Angus, I thought. He was looking for Angus Fair. But Angus had gone before he entered. Or at least I believed he had. And well away, I hoped. Wrapped in a cloak Fergus handed me, I was soon asleep, liking the smell and taste of the wind, and the salt water that occasionally spattered over the bow. Where was it we were going? To Lewes or to Skye? When next I opened my eyes, the sea was rolling heavily, and it had grown colder. The wind blew strong, and McCaskill huddled near me, wrapped in his sheepskin. After a while, I fell again to sleep, tired from my long walking and much worry. When I opened my eyes at last, the dawn was in the sky. Dark and shadowed were the waters where we lay. Silent, but for the lap of waves against the hull, and against the rocks not far off. The shore was only a little way over there, but the water between us was cold. Cold. I looked toward the shore, and could see only the darkness and the bold outline of a cliff. How could I guess that it would be a year before I left this place? Chapter 15. The dwelling to which we came was a crofter's hut on Loch Langeig, and a comfortable place it was, seeming as old as the Isle of Skye itself. I had believed it was Lewes we were bound for, but McCaskill made a change of direction. We arrived in the cold grey of a rain-filled morning. Weary from our voyage, we slept until the sun was high. Then, no longer to be denied the sense of where I was, I went outside to look around. It was a place of foxglove and bracken, where black rushes lined the water of the loch, and birds flew low over the rocky shores. A good place it was, a quiet place and a hidden place, for no other crofts were near, only wild lands, unbroken by the plough. The cottage itself was built in a hollow of the land, so that only the thatch of the roof could be seen from a short distance off. "Do you like it, lad?" Fergus McCaskill had come from the hut behind me. "Aye, a lovely place it is. This is your home, then?" "From time to time. A man with enemies should not abide too long in one place." "Are the McCaskills of Skye?" "Some live over on Lewes as well. It is said that long ago we lived on Man, and were of Viking blood, coming from the north to raid this coast, then settling here. We are restless folk, born to the sea and wild lands. Often of a night, lying awake, I think I shall go off to America and find a home there." "There are savages in America, they say." "Aye, and no doubt they are no worse than we, lad. In my time, I have seen a sight of fighting and killing, and not a little of murder. Although I've fought no man unfairly, myself. No part of the world, I'm thinking, has a sole claim on savagery. There's a bit of it in us all, given the time and place and circumstance. It is said some of our people did go long since." "Aye, Brendan from your island and Sinclair from ours." An old woman appeared from the bracken as though rising from it, and I saw for the first time a path there. She spoke to Fergus, and her Gaelic held a wild, strange sound,
unlike any I'd heard, but pleasant to the ear. It set me to thinking of the bagpipes sounding across the moors. She went within, and I stood watching the grey-lag geese flying low across the marshes. It was a wild place, a lonely place, but marvellously green and secret.
"We will have summat to eat soon, Tant, and then we will get to it."
"Why do you trouble yourself with me?" I asked. "Grateful it is that I am, but why?" He stared out across the loch, then kicked a small pebble at his feet.
"You can ask, lad, and well you should, but the reasons are more than one, and I'll not trouble you with them all. I like a fighter. Let it be that at first. I have fought beside the Irish and found them strong men and willing, and once too, a man took time with me when I knew nothing and was but a lonely lad, not unlike you. There's another reason, stronger than all else, but I'll not tell you now, only this. I know who you are, Tatten Chantre, and know that is none of your name. What your true name is, I shall not say, but that I know it, and there's a blood link between us, long ago though it be. There's still another thing. I am a lonely man, with neither chick nor child, and no wife to my bed, nor proper home. I am a man feared and respected, yet a man with nothing. Once I wished I might have a son like you, with your fine shoulders and fine way of standing, with your clear eyes and the decency in you. But that was in another land, and the one who might have been... Well, I'll say no more. My father is dead. I would be honoured to be your son, Fergus MacCaskill. He put a rough hand on my shoulder. Lad, I've tears in my eyes. You'll make a woman of Fergus MacCaskill with tears and all. My adopted son then, Tat. Let us get our blades now and have at it.
With his great hands and the strength of him, I'd not have believed he could handle a foil as he did. But it took me but a moment to sense that here was a master. My skill, which I had thought great, and which Corey had thought great as well, was as nothing here. He had the reach of me, and the height too, but it was the skill that made the difference. For an hour we fenced, and he tried me in all ways, saying little at first, feeling me out, testing my responses, leading me into attack and defence with consummate skill. Then we put up our blades and went inside for a draught of ale and the gruel and meat the old woman had put on for us. There was thick cream, too, from those wild Highland cattle. All red they were, and maned like lions, with a fine breath of horn upon them.
"You do well," Fergus said, "and you have been well taught, to a point. You have a strong wrist for your size, and you are cool. We'll work with the rapier for a bit, and then with the claymore. For that, we'll need stronger hands than you have. Although you've fine shoulders, we can make them better."
He took a bite of the coarse black bread and looked up from under his brows.
"Can you use a longbow? A weapon of bygone times now, but a good one still, and one easily provided for yourself."
"A little I've used them," I said, "and a sling and quarter-staff as well."
"Good. We shall have a time, we two."
And so it was. A month passed, then two and three. We fenced, boxed, and walked upon the shores and the mountains. Together we climbed the Stour, and walked the high ridges, and went down into the black gorges. Sometimes we walked in sunlight, and sometimes in the deepest fog. At times, MacCaskill would leave me to my own devices, and be gone a day or two. Then he'd come back. One morning, when we drank our ale, he indicated the glass.
"Be sparing with that, lad. I drink, but unlike many of those about, I am never drunken.
When I have my wits about me, I feel I can handle any man or any circumstance. But when a man's wits are foggy, he will do foolish things. I saw one of the greatest swordsmen killed by a mere lad because he had indulged too much, drinking wine until the small hours. He was unsteady, unsure, and his skill was off, although he'd not believe it when we warned him. He died when he need not. There were days when we stayed quiet about the cottage, for there was a feud raging between the MacDonalds and the MacLeods, and much blood was lost. "When the time comes, Tat," he said, "I shall fight. Until then, let them be at it and leave me alone. There has been enough of killing. All about us, in this place called Trotternish, which is a northern arm of Skye, the MacLeods once held the land. Then the MacDonalds took it from them by force of arms. It has ever been so. The strong move in and occupy land as they will. All across the world it has been thus. It is the way of the world, Tat. When I was a lad, I thought little of such things, but as I grew older, the why of things worried my thoughts like a dog worries a bone. We MacCaskills are the descendants of Vikings, who raided down from the north, as I have said, and we wedded women of the isles. The Gaels they were. Much did I talk in the dark hours with men of wisdom, and warriors met from other lands, and everywhere it was the same. The men of the north wanted warmer, richer lands. The men of poor cities wanted the wealth of the rich, and so they came raiding and looting, then finally settling down to be raided in their turn. So it will be in the new lands beyond the sea, and so it has been in those lands long before any white man came upon them. Long ago, when I was but a lad, we took a Spanish vessel on the high seas, and brought her a prize to Skye. Aboard that vessel was a great Spanish lord, and my father held him for ransom, as is the custom. We waited months for the ransom to come, and I spent many hours with the prisoner, for he lived as one of our own family. He told me of Cortez and his conquering of the Aztec peoples. He said Cortez could never have done it, had it not been for Indian allies, tribes recently conquered by the Aztecs, who hated them. The Aztecs lived in great cities of stone, but those cities were built or begun by other peoples who came before. The Toltecs, for example, and others even before them. So you see, Tat, we hold this land only for a time. Whether we win it in peace or war, we hold it only in trust for other peoples and other generations. When I was a wild lad, I thought only of the sword and of fighting. I loved the wild raids, the fierce attacks, the crossing of blades. It mattered little who it was I fought. The fight itself was the thing. Yet with time, I have grown wiser. I still like the battle. It is in my blood. But I also question myself and try to learn from others. A soldier in a lifetime meets many kinds of people. And so it has been with me. I had listened in silence, but now I had a question for him. But if the MacDonalds hold Trotternish, how does it happen that you can be here when you are of the MacLeods? Oh, they let me be. Perhaps they think me not worth the trouble, for I am seldom here. They know when I am here, and they know when I come and go, but they walk a wide circle. Afraid? Not the MacDonalds. I know them too well to think they fear. I have shed MacDonald blood, and this they know. Yet I believe they like me a little, and think perhaps I am better left alone. Someday, someday one of them may come seeking me. One or many. It is to be expected. We fenced and fought with this weapon and that, and I could feel my skill growing, and my confidence. He was a great master. Whenever I seemed ready to equal him, he uncovered a new trick, a new stratagem, a new device. His eyes would twinkle a little, and he would look at me slyly, enjoying the moment. There came a night when we sat by the fire. Food was eaten, the dishes put aside, and there was rain upon the roof. Occasionally, a gust of wind whined under the eaves. Firelight played on McCaskill's cheekbones, his shaggy brows, and the old scar.
"Aye," he said, "there have been bloody times. Do you ken the Isle of Egg? 'Tis yonder."
He gestured toward the south. A few years back, some MacLeod lads denied the hospitality of the MacDonalds, butchered a beef upon the shore. But before they could flee, they were come upon by the MacDonalds, who whipped them brutally. Norman, he who was the 11th chief of the MacLeods, sent out his fleet. The MacDonalds, seeing themselves outnumbered, took their whole population into a cave and hid themselves. This was in 1577, if I recall. The MacLeods searched but could not find them, and were sailing away when one of the MacDonalds, impatient to see had they gone, came from the cave and was seen. They tracked him by new-fallen snow, and when the MacDonalds would not come out, the MacLeods gathered brush and seaweed from shore and hill and placed it before the opening and set fire to it. All inside were smothered and killed. Not a one of the nearly 400 survived. Was that an end to it, then?
Is it ever? Ah, tat,
we are a vengeful people, we Scots. The MacDonalds waited, and they watched, and they lurked about, wanting a chance for vengeance. It came on a Sunday morning. They slipped into the bay under the cover of a fog, and they barred the door of the church, which was filled with MacLeods. And then they put a fire to the church and burned them alive, all but one woman who somehow escaped. Word had reached Dunvegan Castle, where the MacLeods had gathered.
Ah, how I remember that day. I was there, mind. I saw it with my own eyes,
and did some of the killing that was done, too. For I lost a friend or two in that burning church, and a girl who...
Well, no mind to that. I was there. Our galleys were swift, and the church took long to burn, and they stood about so that none might escape, beyond the one woman who did.
Then, when the church was down, and in embers and blackened stones, they took their loot and returned to their own boats. But they had reckoned without the tides, for their craft were beached high and dry by the ebb tide. And here were the MacLeods coming, and their fairy flag flying too. I was the first man ashore, leaping from the bow of our galley and rushing forward. An instant, and I was alone, surrounded by MacDonalds, and my claymore was out and swinging as I charged into them. Then all the MacLeods were ashore, and the MacDonalds fell back to the stone dike, protecting the shorelands from the sea. They put their backs to the wall, and they faced us. Ah, what a fight that was! The MacDonalds were men. Fight them I did, but I hated them not a whit. I loved them for their strength and their valour, and the grand fight they made. It was sword and sword. I had cut two down in that first rush, but they had nicked me a time or two, and we set to it. In my time I have seen fights, but never a better one than there against the sea wall in the light of a waning day. Again and again they charged us. Again and again we drove them back. Yes, we outnumbered them. We surely did. But before it was over, I was glad for our numbers, although we cut them down, every man. Again and again, during the weeks that followed, did MacCaskill regale me with stories of the fighting between the clans. For they were a hardy and ferocious lot, willing to fight at the drop of a hat, and to drop it themselves. Several times we sailed to Lewes, once to Egg, and to rum. I became more skillful at handling a boat in a rough sea. It was on one of these days, as we tied the boat after such a voyage, that I suddenly realized I was 15 years old. For months I had fenced, boxed, wrestled, walked, climbed, and sailed. The food we ate was simple indeed. The life we lived was along the shore of the loch, or on the sea itself, and I had grown, both in height and in strength. Immeasurably had I grown in skill. The sunlight had gone from the loch that day, and the wind was picking a few white caps from the crests of the small waves. The reeds were bending, and ripples ran through the grassland as it bent before the wind. I had come up from the loch with several fish, fresh caught from the cold water. For a moment, as I often did, I stepped up on a small hillock near the cottage and looked over the moorland. It was then I saw him, a rider on a grey horse, mane and tail streaming in the wind, the horse coming fast, weaving and turning to avoid obstructions of rocks or clumps of heather. "Fergus," I called it, not too loud, but above the wind. He came to the door, book in hand. "A rider," I said, "and he comes with grief and danger in his arms." He came up beside me.
"Aye," he said, "when they come that fast, it is always trouble. Gather what you will take, lad, for we will be going now."
Chapter 16. Huddled for warmth we were, a hard wind blowing and the shortened sail frozen stiff, with a strong sea running. The blown spray was like icy needles against exposed flesh. We had no means with which to war against wind and sea, but could only ride them and keep what hope we had for living. The waves were like walls of black ice rolling down upon us, their crests broken like bared teeth, and spray driven before them like hail. It was no place I wished to be, and I could only think of the snug cot we'd left beside the loch, and a peat fire burning on the hearth. Three fishermen were with us, for the boat was theirs, a boat built for these strong northern seas they lived upon. Yet I knew from their faces that our condition was not one to seek, but to fear. The Scots and the Norwegians of the Shetland, Orkney, and Hebrides Islands had galleys, 16 to 24 oars, and in wartime, three men to the oar. They had Berlins too, a smaller craft with 12 to 16 oars. Our craft was none of these, but a simple fisher's boat, fit for riding rough seas with a cargo of fish. Now she was empty but for us. No voice was raised, for none could be heard above the wind, and we huddled together, clutching our useless swords and losing our hearts each time the boat dipped into a trough between the waves. Southward we drove, with the shores of Scotland far and away to the east, and on the west all the wide width of the Atlantic. Our fishermen knew the strength of wind and wave, and how to handle their boat. We slid steeply down the slope of one wave, only to rise abruptly on the cliff of the next. Fergus MacCaskill sat beside me, staring grimly into the storm, his beard streaming with blown water, his face like that of a graven image, hard cut against the wind, his eyes bleak as the storm clouds above. Sharply he leaned forward, staring into the storm drift that obscured all before and around us. Something ominous and dark loomed there, low down on the horizon. MacCaskill grasped a fisherman's arm, pointing.
"Jura!"
he shouted, and I knew the name for an island. The fisherman bobbed his grave head. Pointing to the westward, he shouted another name I could not make out. I saw him fighting to point our bow toward the black mass. I clung to the boat. Suddenly, she seemed to be making a hard time of it, and I sensed that something was wrong. The fishermen began scooping water from the bottom and tossing it by the board, but I saw no sense to it,
for the next moment a great wave would leave us as full as before. She felt soggy and slower to rise, her buoyancy gone. We seemed to be tangled in something, or caught in some underwater wreckage or mass of seaweed. Then, through a break in the clouds, we saw the island looming near, what must be the northwest coast of Jura. Fergus MacCaskill grasped my arm. In his hand, he held a small sack which he thrust at me. When I tried to push it away, he would have none of it. So I hid the sack in my clothes to argue another time. He put his mouth to my ear and shouted, "Don't wait for her to strike! When we are closer, swim!" Swim? In that? I could only ask the question of myself. How far to shore? A half mile and closing. There were rocks along the shore so far as I could see, but the visibility was poor. The boat was down now, well down. The gunwales were awash, but whatever was beneath her held us fast. Looking up, I beheld a snarl of raging white water, tremendous combers crashing upon a shore with a thunder beyond belief. We rose upon a giant wave, and I then saw the shore, only a short distance away now, the wind shrieking and howling like all the banshees in hell. Suddenly Fergus grasped my arm. "No!" he roared, and, leaping up, he dove into the waves as two of the fishermen went with him. Only the old man sat still, and I, who had leaped up, grasped his arm. "Come!" I shouted. He looked up and smiled, then shook his head. And then the moment was past. The backwash of a great wave carried us away. I started to jump, then realized we were even further out now. Wind and current, by some trickery of the sea, were carrying us further out and down the coast. I crouched beside the aged man, clutching his thin old arm. Too late! The moment had come, and they had seized it, and I, like a fool, had hesitated. Only the old man was calm, no doubt resigned to death. Either he could not swim, or he lacked the strength, so chose to sink with the boat or ride with it. And now I had no choice but to accompany him. Yet it was not in me to sit, to yield. I must see and do. Rising, I lunged toward the mast and linked an arm about it, staring into the storm. The wind ripped at my clothes and body with brutal fingers, yet I clung. Glancing down, I saw the old man's fingers move, so he was yet alive. We were afloat. At least, we seemed to have ceased to sink, and being carried by the sea, off to what seemed the southwest. Yet now the waves were again sweeping us toward the shore. A great gulf or bay opened to the southward, and I saw enormous waves hurrying one after the other into that vast maw, as if the gulf were swallowing the sea in great gulps. The old man was almost shoulder deep in the water. I clung, one arm wrapped around the mast, but squatting, I reached for him. He did not resist, but came up beside me. He said something, shaping the sounds with his lips, but the wind robbed me of their meaning. The shore was rushing upon us now, or we upon it, and I clung hard, both to the mast and to the old man. Suddenly, the waves seemed to lift us and throw us bodily upon the shore. We landed with a crash, thrown clear of the boat and sprawled breathless on the gravelly shore. Scrambling to my feet, I grasped the old man and lifted him to the grass above the reach of the sea. Then I rushed back to what remained of our boat and its pile of weed. The sea was rushing in again, and there was but a moment. With a wild grab, I caught up my sword and my bundle. I was searching for the bundle Fergus had brought, but was too late. The sea tore it from my grasp, and the wreckage of the boat was again carried back upon the waves. I found the old man lying at the edge of the maca, and helped him to his feet. Together we staggered back over the wildflowers and grass, our only thought to escape still further from the clutching fingers of the sea. We paused then,
gasping to catch our breath. The old man suddenly grasped my arm, pointing. Horsemen were riding toward us.
"Speak no word of MacCaskill,"
he warned hoarsely. "These be MacDonalds, and enemies to the clan. We are of Ireland, and cast away by the sea." We stood waiting, and I was glad that I carried a sword. There were five of them, and they rode swiftly up. One was a fierce old man with flowing hair and a beard. The others younger, two scarcely more than boys. "What land is this?" I asked. "It is Ayla," one of the younger boys said. "Ah, it is not Jura?" "Jura is the next island, just yonder," he said. He was about my own age, but not so tall. He studied me curiously.
"Where are you for?"
"Oban," I lied, yet not quite a lie, for eventually we would have reached there. "Then on across and to France."
"To school? Do you study there?"
"Aye," I said, for did I not study everywhere? "And mayhap to find a place in the army."
"Who are you then?"
He was the old man with the beard, a strong, fine old man.
"Tatton Chantry, and I am of Ireland.
This old man is a fisherman who was taking me on when the storm took us. Our boat was wrecked, and all I have is about me."
"You saved your sword,"
the old man said. His eyes were sharp, and I felt he missed nothing.
"Aye,"
I said dryly. "For a man without a sword on a strange shore, or anywhere, who is he?"
"Can you use it, then?"
"A bit," I said. "I wish to learn."
"Donal,"
the bearded man said,
"do you take him behind you? And Charles, do you take the other? We'll see no man hunger upon our shore."
"Our? You still call it that?" said Donal. "'Tis no longer ours, and we've no the right to be here, as you'll see if we come upon any of them."
"Well not,"
the old man replied easily.
"They be far from here, as we have been told, so we'll get what we came for and be off."
"And what of them?" Charles asked. The old man looked at us again.
"We'll take them with us. They'll not speak of what they see."
He looked at me.
"Will you know, Tatton Chantry? I will see the way to Oban and your faces, and will remember how you found us upon the sea." "Well spoken. We'll be off then."
We rode swiftly inland over the Macha. I could see the blue of a lake, and then we circled and came back to where some grey stones lay. One of the men swung down and made as if to dig.
"Hold fast," the bearded man spoke sharply. "Cut the turf in squares, and when we have what we want, put it carefully back so that no man may know what we find here."
He looked hastily around.
"Scatter out and keep alert. We'll want no visitors now."
With the others, I helped keep watch. Yet from time to time, I glanced around. The digging was done with care, the turf taken out in great blocks. I heard the shovel grate upon something metallic, and then a chest was lifted from the earth. Dirt was wiped from it, and it was lifted to a horse's back. The horse was a powerful one, evidently brought for the purpose. Yet he had no liking for the heavy burden. Then the turf was replaced, and we started swiftly off. The others glanced back again and again. "I had heard this was MacDonald earth," I said.
"Aye,"
the bearded old man replied grimly.
"It was once so. Yet now the Campbells have it, and I blame them not for taking what they could get, and making sure they kept it. Yet in my eyes it will be MacDonald land forever."
We rounded a great pile of rock and came to a hidden cove. A boat lay there, and as we came into sight, the men on board put down a gangway that led to the shore. Soon the horses were aboard, and ourselves with them. Staggering with weariness, I found a corner away from the wind and lay down, and the old man with me. Not 3 hours had passed since we came ashore. The gale still raged out on the sea, yet we lay